This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Kirsten Diprose.
When did you first learn about your pelvic floor? As a school student, you might have been taught about periods, but not so much pelvic health or endometriosis. But that's about to change. And this education will be provided to not just girls, but boys as well. This is all part of removing the stigma and mystery around women's health, which has ultimately led to women and girls suffering from pain in silence, going untreated, thinking it was all normal. Good morning, Kirsten Diprose here with you for the Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria, filling in for Mary Guerin. A new program, jointly funded by federal and state governments, will see specialist pelvic health educators come to schools across the country to discuss women's health issues that have previously been off the table. We'll be joined by women's health physiotherapist and educator who has long been calling for greater education on endometriosis and still says there's more to be done. Also this hour, doctors in Victorian public hospitals are edging closer towards strike action. What does this mean for our health system, which is already under pressure? And I want to know, what's your most beloved music poster? Does it commemorate a favourite band's tour, perhaps a teenage music crush, or a special time in your life? An absolute treasure trove in Thornbury is being opened up soon, 40 years worth of rock posters, and we'll get a sneak peek later this hour. So tell me, what is a poster, a music poster that you hold dear?
This is The Conversation Hour with Kirsten Diprose.
We're asking today as well about what did you learn when you were at school about periods, pelvic health, endometriosis. I still struggle saying it, and I think it's because I didn't know about it, I think, until I was well into my 20s. And I don't think I knew about the pelvic floor until my 30s after having children. So does this need to change? Really, it shouldn't be that revolutionary. Periods, pelvic pain and endometriosis being taught in schools to girls alongside boys. But that's what's happening. It's going to be delivered by trained educators from the Pelvic Pain Foundation of Australia, and it's being rolled out to 1,000 schools across Australia. Joining me now is Jess Fishburne, a pelvic floor and pain physiotherapist, as well as a pelvic health educator, who has actually been going around to schools across her region in southwest Victoria well before this government-funded program began. Jess Fishburne, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Kirsten.
So tell me first, why is it something that you started long ago?
For a couple of reasons. Number one was I would have patients come in to see me in the clinic and they would say to me, why didn't I learn this? Why don't I know this information? And so I would then take that information into schools because it was things like, what's normal with your pelvic health, what's normal with pain, and taking it right to the time that we're learning it. I also, or that we, in my mind, should be learning it. I also could see that with the right education, right from the get-go when we're starting our periods, if we can get support for women and girls that are experiencing pelvic pain and endometriosis or adenomyosis, we can actually improve their quality of life for the rest of their menstrual life, as opposed to trying to unwind a very heightened nervous system 20 years after they've started menstruating.
Why are we in this predicament where this sort of thing is just unknown and women are only finding out about whether it's endometriosis or what a normal period looks like when they're, you know, 20s, 30s? How old are they when they're kind of finding out?
Sometimes I'm getting women come into the clinic and they are in their late 20s, early 30s, and they're finally wanting to do something about it, or it's impacting on their quality of life, so they can't, they're not able to have sex, or they're not able to attend work because they're experiencing really horrific period pain each month. I think the question to why is this been presenting and why are we only, you know, really talking about it now, that really comes back to the shame and the stigma associated with anything to do with women's health and women's reproductive health. It's just been, many years, it's actually just been unknown because we haven't had the research. We haven't had the funding put into the research. We haven't had the research done on us as women to then understand what's going on. So we're seeing it in the media. We're seeing a really big push because finally we've got really extensive research coming out. How many women are impacted, or how many of those that menstruate are impacted by endometriosis? And then the cost of that, what it's having on the economy. We've lost hours at work, lost hours at school. I think that that's why we're starting to see a change, but it's so much has been shrouded in shame and stigma.
And thank you to the ABC Brains Trust, Vicky, Deb and Mary, who have all texted in to make sure I get endometriosis correct when I pronounce it. So thank you. I love our listeners. With this new program that is being funded by federal and state governments, so 1,000 schools, what do you know about it and, you know, is this the right direction?
Absolutely. So the PEP program has been going for a few years now, but it hasn't had the state and national funding to really get it into all schools. And hopefully in the future, it will be any school student, male or female, will actually get this information. But it's come out from the Pelvic Pain Foundation of Australia, based out of Adelaide, and the incredible work of Susan Evans and her team. So Susan is a gynaecologist who has really been the forefront of that organisation to get the information into schools and not just specifically girls. For so long, every time I get invited to go into a school, and as you said in the intro, I've been going into schools really since 2018 in our region to take this information, but I'm always invited. It's always or the teachers or the nurses are reaching out and saying, we've got a number of girls that are missing school or they're having problems with their periods. We don't know what to do about it. Can you come in and talk to everyone? And usually it is me coming in and talking to the girls only because I've had the example of where I've been rushed into an auditorium and hushed and the doors closed like we're doing secret women's business, which is just including and, you know, pertaining the stigma associated. Whereas I love that it's being addressed at a you know, the whole school level or the entire class level, because while the males may not be experiencing the pain, they are likely going to be living with women, married to women, have sisters, have friends that are experiencing it. So endometriosis, the current statistics are 1 in 6 women will experience or will be diagnosed with endometriosis over their lifespan, which is more common than asthma. It's more common than diabetes. And we do not have the research or the evidence. Up until now, we haven't had the research or the evidence to actually give us a really good language around it and our treatment options available. And number one, the best treatment option is learning about why you hurt.
Jess Fishburne, what are the boys' reactions when you go into schools and you start talking about these women's issues? You know, are they comfortable with it?
I have noticed in the last 5 years that they're getting more comfortable with it. There's definitely an openness to be like, actually, you know, I can't believe that this is what my sister or my mum has been going through. But definitely the first time that I would go in, it would be very much giggle, you know, this is period. Can't believe, you know, we'd be talking about menstrual cups or tampons, and sometimes those things are not able to be used in girls and women who experience horrific pelvic pain because their pelvic floor muscles are so engaged or overactive. We don't actually use the word overactive too much anymore, but they've got such high tone to them. And, you know, as soon as you can really layer just some really clear impacts that has on the women and the girls in their lives, they really understand. They're like, oh, we need to know about this. And it it's not necessarily the shame and stigma with the students itself. It can often be the teachers or the parents that are like, oh, no, you can't talk about this, when in actual fact it's health literacy and it's going to improve our whole community functioning if we have adequate health literacy.
What about talking about, pain during sex, which can be an issue caused by the pelvis? Is that something that, schools, whether it's parents or teachers or students, feel comfortable talking about?
Yeah, great question. Anytime I'm invited into a school to talk, and if they're asking me to talk about periods and pelvic health and pelvic pain, I will give them the heads up that I would like to talk about sexual pain, because our highest rates of female sexual pain is between 16 to 21-year-olds. And so if I'm talking to year 10s or year 11s, that is the age bracket that is experiencing this. And there can be some pushback, particularly on the schools that have a religious background. They can say, no, that doesn't align with our values, that's not appropriate. I do respect that. But it is really challenging because these girls and people are having painful sex and then layering the nervous system to expect painful sex. And then by the time they're coming in to see me in the clinic in their late 20s, early 30s, or even into their 40s, they're like, well, this is the norm. It's only ever been painful. And then the nervous system protectively adapts to that, which is not great. So it's definitely a nuanced topic. It can be met with a bit of resistance, but the more that I'm prompting it and explaining the reason why that these women are sexually active, or, that this is the main age bracket that are experiencing it, then they're a lot more open to actually, yeah, let's have the conversation. And it sits with period pain, but also things like PMS and PMDD, which is premenstrual dysphoric disorder, which is a really severe form of PMS. And, the teachers are not equipped to know the information and how to address these questions, or how to even deliver the information. They might not know what these conditions are themselves, like you mentioned. So it is really, it's great that locally these schools are wanting me to come in as a subject matter expert to deliver it. And so it's so good that the PEP program is now actually delivering this into schools across Australia. My whole take on it is that it should be, health literacy should be in the curriculum, but it's definitely not up to the teachers to have to teach it. They do such a wonderful job of everything that they have to teach. I think if they can get subject matter experts to come in to teach, they're going to have the right language. They can disarm the embarrassment and the stigma so that it's actually just factual information.
Jess Fishburne is with us, pelvic floor and pain physiotherapist and pelvic health educator. And we've got a lot of text messages, Jess, of women sharing their stories. Endometriosis can cause horrific referred pain to muscles and fascia in the back, legs, arms and neck from puberty, while pelvic pain may be the lesser pain. Another text talks about how her daughter has had endometriosis and adenomyosis. Jess, can you check my pronunciation?
Adenomyosis,
thank you. Her life has been derailed by these debilitating conditions. As soon as painful periods are reported, interventions must begin to stop the progression. Yes. My daughter has experienced, despite having specialist care. That's from Bayside Mum. And another text message, between 15 and 45, I suffered horrendous period pain and cataclysmic bleeding. My GPs were totally uninterested and inclined to tell me that was a women's burden. Age 45, I had a hysterectomy. Now I'm 80. Looking back, and I think how young I was and how ignorant were my doctors. It's great that times has changed. From Sue.
Yeah.
I mean, you must hear all these stories all the time, Jess, but you've had your own experience with endometriosis. How did you, as someone who, lives this and is learning this and is now an expert in this, deal with endo? I suppose it came well before your physiotherapist days, though.
Absolutely. And so I am hearing these stories time and time again, and particularly the the age-old adage of, we'll just remove the uterus and it will fix the problem, which it doesn't. And, you know, have a baby, it will fix the endo, which it doesn't. You know, we're now able to disarm all of this incorrect information that well-meaning but ill-informed health professionals, if they're not specialised in it, they're not necessarily going to be across the latest information. But back for your listener who is in her 80s now, we wouldn't have even had a language around endometriosis back then. And it breaks my heart that that was her experience. And it gives me hope that this is what's to come for future generations, that we are going to have a better narrative around it. In terms of my own experience, I got my period as a, I was quite late getting my period. I was 17. I thought it was great until it arrived and I thought, oh my gosh. And my mum has really was suffered with endometriosis her entire menstrual life. And I went to the doctor, same thing, no, you're fine. Periods are normal, painful periods are normal. You take some Panadol, take some Plonstan, take some Naprogesic, get on with it. And it got to the point where I was fainting at uni and I was just pushing through and fainting. Very inconvenient in really embarrassing places. And then I finally got a diagnosis from, again, quite a generalist gynecologist who at the time, and I was 24 and working as a pelvic floor physio, a very junior pelvic floor physio at this point, but was told to, okay, have a baby, it will fix your endometriosis and you'll be fine. And I got on... Which is diabolical. This was 2014.
That's not that long ago.
It's not that long ago. That's exactly right. And I got onto the Endo Australia website and saw that it said, you know, see a pelvic floor physio. And here I was, a junior pelvic floor physio at this point, being like, what can I do for myself? And I don't think that actually really encouraged my path down. So I've done a postgrad in pain science and pain education through UniSA as a result of seeing so many patients experience persistent pain as well. And with that, I was I have a role now to educate our local health professionals through the local pain educator program to be better versed and upskill the way that we actually discuss not only pelvic pain, but all pain. And like your listener said, you know, it can then lead to an upregulated nervous system. And we can see women experience pelvic pain, abdominal pain, jaw pain, headaches, foot pain. It's all linked, particularly when the pelvic floor is in a really heightened position. The same thing happens with the diaphragm and our upper trap muscles, which are a big muscle in our neck. Which then just, you know, if you go to the physio and you say, I've got constant headaches and constant neck pain, they're more likely to actually understand the language and be able to treat that, as opposed to in the past going and saying, I've got this constant pelvic pain. It's, you know, been such a mystery. So I am very fortunate that I, between diet, exercise, mindfulness, techniques. I do a lot to actually down-regulate my nervous system. I do lots of education to patients about down-regulating your nervous system. And learning about your pain and learning why you hurt is really the first step to help your steps to recovery. I say to every single patient that comes through my door, whether they are a pelvic pain patient or a complex pain patient that's been referred, you know, I get referrals from people that have had failed surgeries and have still got pain. And the big thing that I say is have hope. And I think that I really encourage that hope stands for hold on, pain ends.
Oh, I like that. Jess Fishburne, I think we are out of time, unfortunately, but I think you've provided a lot of hope to a lot of listeners now who might be sitting there thinking, oh, okay, maybe I can follow this up. And getting that education started from a young age is so important. So thank you so much for joining us on the program.
My pleasure. Thank you for having the conversation. It's a very important one.
Jess Fishburne there, pelvic floor and pain physiotherapist based in Southwest Victoria, pelvic health educator as well. A lot of your text messages, this one, great work. I remember 30 plus years ago, my late wife coming home from the doctor in tears because she'd been referred to a psychiatrist. She was asking if I thought she was making it up. Wow. Another text says, this is wonderful. Maybe your classes could be accessed online. Yeah, that's it. I think there are generations of people who need some catch-up lessons.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Kirsten Diprose.
Coming up, we're looking at the beloved music poster. What is yours? The one that maybe takes you back to a lovely time in your life. Maybe it was a band that you loved, a teenage music crush, perhaps. 1300 222 774, or you can text 0437 774 774. Murray is on the line. G'day, Murray.
Hi, Kirsten. How are you this morning?
I'm good. I believe you wrote a rock poster book.
Yes, and you mentioned Nick. We used lots of, almost all of Nick's poster collection in that book. But
as in Nick Cave?
No, Nick Vukovic, although there is a Nick Cave poster in there.
Yep.
But we sourced a lot of them from John DeQuino at Rock Posters, where the Open Melbourne show's on. And I'd have to urge people, if they're into poster art, to get onto that show and have a look at it. It's fantastic.
What got you into posters and the art around it?
When I was younger, guy, I used to peel them off walls and stick them up in my bedroom, and I've just always liked them. And I realised that I wasn't the only person doing that. That I think nearly everyone had a poster in their bedroom wall or behind the toilet door. And I thought it's strange that such an all-pervasive thing has never been studied. So I thought, well, let's have a look at it and see what we can find.
And do you have a favourite poster? If you could name one, what would it be and why?
Oh, dear. Kirsten, there are so many that I saw. I think there's a really great birthday party poster that was actually designed by Nick Cave that was really, really graphic. But we couldn't actually use it in the book because Nick was touring his movie and we couldn't get his signature on the permissions form before deadline. It's a wonderful poster. It'll probably be at Rock Posters in Thornbury.
Yeah, which is why we're talking about this. And we're going to get a sneak peek with the general manager of Rock Posters about what is inside. It's like a vault of 40 years. So very excited. Murray, thank you so much for calling in. What's your Rock Poster book? What's it called?
Plastered.
Of course. What a great name.
Plastered, the poster art of Australian popular music. But I think you'll find it's out of print at the moment. It sold out twice and I think it's now out of print.
Oh, who's doing your PR, Murray? You've got to get onto it. Thank you so much for calling in.
My pleasure.
Murray Rolding there, who wrote a rock poster book, has lots of favourite posters. I want to know yours. Where does it take you back to? Did you take them down from the street?
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Kirsten Diprose.
Well, there's concern for the vulnerable men who have been living at a Footscray residential facility, which is in the process of shutting down. Foley House has provided beds for homeless men, many of which have disabilities, including acquired brain injuries and other complex health needs since 2013. But the Salvation Army, which runs Foley House, says the site is no longer sustainable and will start moving residents to other affordable accommodation this week. Shifra Bluestein is from Footscray Community Response. Shifra, thank you for joining us. Can you tell us about Foley House and why it's so important to the community?
Look, there aren't many of these facilities in all of Melbourne and certainly not in Footscray. There are about 40 men in Foley House who were promised forever homes after long and traumatic histories of homelessness. They all have very serious disabilities requiring a high level of support, and that's what they have been provided with at Foley House. As recently as 2023, the Salvos made a promotional video, which you can still see on YouTube, showing how effective the service is, how much the men feel supported and like they belong there. The issue is that in Footscray and in Melbourne and across the state, we're seeing the systematic loss and destruction of both supported housing and public housing. We're in a really severe housing and homelessness crisis. the Selvo shouldn't be closing this vital housing, and the state government needs to step in if that's what they insist, if that's what the Selvos insist on doing. We've got like a large rough sleeping community in Footscray. They need places like Foley House. Instead, we're losing these beds.
Shifra, we asked the Salvation Army to come on, but we haven't heard back from them. But a spokesperson spoke to ABC Online, and in that they said that there's a dignified and orderly process that is going on, a staggered approach so that people can be rehoused and matched with safe, suitable and affordable accommodation. Is that okay? You know, they are being found alternatives. What's wrong with that process?
Look, the case managers, I understand, are trying really hard to find them suitable alternatives, but there just aren't enough of these kind of places in the whole city. We've been told that residents of Foley House will likely be pushed back into homelessness because of the inadequacy of the accommodation they're being moved into. So when the accommodation is not suitable to their needs, it's not going to be sustainable. They're going to end back on the streets. The other part of it is that Foley House residents who are being moved into other services are taking beds that others in the community need. So the Salvos is reducing the already extremely limited number of these crucial supported beds when there are thousands of others who need them.
I understand the Salvation Army said that the Foley House had become disability-like accommodation, but without the access to any form of accommodation funding other than the Salvation Army themselves. Is that part of the reason? Like, was Foley House not equipped to deal with the complex needs?
That's not what we understand. So the men in Foley House, I mean, they had these serious disabilities when they arrived there, some up to 10 years ago. They were told that it was their forever home. The Salvation Army is not the sole source of funding from what we've been told. All the men are on NDIS packages, and the Salvos are, you know, I guess their funding is supplemented by significant NDIS packages of all the residents. The other thing is that the Salvation Army is not like a poor service. They have an annual income of about $1.3 billion. So we think this is a problem of priorities, not of funding.
Is Foley House a community as well? Like, what are the men saying? If they've been living there since 2013, is it, you know, it's their home, their community?
Absolutely. That's how people describe it. On that promo video that I mentioned, they were describing it as their family, somewhere that they can go and talk to people, feel like they belong. They watch the footy together. They celebrate their birthdays together. They played in a band together. These are men who are among the most marginalised people in our community, and they finally had this place where they were accepted and where they belonged, and now they're losing it and they face going back to the streets.
So how did Footscray Community Response get involved in this, and, you know, do you think it can be saved?
Well, look, we do think it can be saved. Footscray Community Response got involved. We heard about it and we're really concerned. We've been advocating for the rights of people experiencing homelessness in Footscray, and here we are with a situation where more people are at risk of being made homeless. We think the state government can fix this with the stroke of a pen. If the Salvos don't want to run it anymore, that's fine. I'm pretty sure there would be many other not-for-profit services who would take it on. The government could run it as a publicly run facility. We need more of these places, but we're losing so many of these essential services and housing, and it has huge repercussions for the state government, I mean, in terms of its budget, in terms of kind of all the problems that are created when people lose their secure housing.
How many people live there?
We're told it's about 40 people.
Yeah, so 40 people that are being rehoused. How are you going about, I suppose, raising the issue, and have you had much of a response from government?
No, we haven't. We've written to the Housing Minister, the Disability Minister and our local MP, Katie Hall. None of them have responded. We've also written to the Salvos. We have a petition online that has almost 1,600 signatures. So there is a significant amount of community concern about this, but the police have been, you know, have been ignoring us.
Shifra Bluestein, thank you so much for joining us on the Conversation Hour to raise this issue.
Thank you.
Shifra Bluestein there from the Footscray Community Response. We did also put in a call to the state government, and we had a spokesperson say that they're continuing funding until December 2026 to support residents in the transition process and will work closely with the Salvation Army to make sure no one faces homelessness. The decision to close Foley House was one made independently by the Salvation Army following its own organisational review.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is the Conversation Hour.
You're with Kirsten Diprose.
In just a moment, we'll be finding out what's happening with public hospital doctors who are nearing the point of industrial action. But I also want to know, what is your favourite, most beloved poster? Does it bring back some memories? Have you kept it for many years? On the text line, someone says, I have Murray's book. It rules. Angry that the band I was in wasn't in there, though. Ooh. I don't know who texted that in. Another text says, I have a Soundgarden poster with UMI support. It's psychedelic, says Matt from Eltham. And Mick in Ballarat says, my favourite poster is the Sunbury 75 music festival on the door of my boys' room / workshop under the house. I love it. Do you have a beloved poster? Where do you keep it? What memories does it bring back? You can text on 0437 774 774. Well, we are moving across to Victorian hospitals now, where public hospital doctors are edging closer to possible industrial action after hitting a stalemate over a new pay deal. A meeting was held last night with the Australian Medical Association and the union, the Australian Salaried Medical Officers Federation, where it was agreed to apply for a protected action order with the Fair Work Commission. So how will this impact our hospitals? Dr. Stephanie Davies is with us, Chair of the AMA Victoria Doctor in Training Subdivision. Thank you for joining us, Stephanie.
Thanks for having me, Kirsten.
So where is this at the moment? What happened last night?
So last night we gave all of our members an update of the negotiations, which have been going on for nearly a year now. And we had overwhelming support to move to the next step so that we can see improvement in the conditions for doctors, but also improving the safety of patients in hospital.
What are the main concerns? Is it pay or conditions?
The main concerns are everything. We're seeing shifts unfilled across the state. We're still working up to 14 hours a shift, sometimes longer, and we're really concerned about the fatigue management of public hospital doctors and the safety of the patients.
So how can that be better managed so that, you know, doctors aren't working 14 hours a day?
Well, things we've asked for are things like shortening shift length, having 2 weekends off a fortnight instead of 3.5 days, more sustainable workloads and increasing parental leave. But on many things, we haven't been able to reach agreement, unfortunately.
Is there sort of structural issues? You know, I think it's fair to say that the hospital system, or at least for doctors, has been fairly male-dominated in the past, and so perhaps that flexibility hasn't been built in over time. Are you facing some of those older structural issues that perhaps other industries have overcome?
I think some of it is structural issues, but also the attitude that the work's being done, so why does anything need to be changed? But the truth is that the work is being done by doctors that are tired and burnt out, and we need things to change.
Are we seeing more mistakes happen then in our public hospitals because doctors are tired?
It's absolutely possible for mistakes to happen, and this is why we're so concerned about things at the moment and willing to take the next steps to see that we get the terms that we need.
People listening are probably thinking, oh gosh, it's hard enough to get into hospitals now. What does it mean for patient care and waiting lists?
Well, in terms of proceeding to the next steps, we hope nothing. We'd really like to be able to settle this through negotiation and, if we're able to achieve improved conditions, hopefully we'll be able to shorten waiting times for patients and make doctors more accessible.
Will patient care be protected in the event of a strike or some sort of industrial action?
Our first priority is protecting patient care. I've been asked by many colleagues whether this is something that will be affected, because that's the concern for all doctors, is looking after their patients and why we all work so hard. So that's absolutely not something that's going to be compromised if that it does need to happen.
Yeah, look, you're in a tricky position in that, you know, you're doctors because you like caring for people and that's what you do. What are the pay demands? What would make things better in your view?
What we've asked for in terms of pay is a 30% increase over the 4 years, but also things like penalties for night shifts, weekends, because at the moment we need the conditions to improve to be able to retain doctors in the Victorian public health system.
Dr. Stephanie Davies is with us, Chair of the AMA Victoria Doctor in Training Subdivision. We did request the Minister for Health, Harriet Shing, to speak with us. We were given a statement saying that Victorian doctors in our public healthcare system provide world-class treatment and care all over the state, and we will continue to support them. Negotiations and discussions are continuing in good faith between the Victorian Hospitals Industrial Association and the Australian Salaried Medical Officers Federation. So, Stephanie, the government, they're saying discussions are continuing in good faith. How confident are you that a resolution will be made before having to take industrial action?
I think we're still really hopeful that we can come to an agreement at the table, but we're concerned that many things that we've previously agreed on or made progress on have been completely changed in recent weeks, and that's why we're taking the next steps. But we still hope to resolve it at the table.
What do you mean about completely changed? What's happened?
Well, like we talked about before, in terms of structural issues, we've had a backflip on the progress to removing structural impediments for claiming over time, which is a big issue for public hospital doctors. And that's been one of the many issues that we've not been able to reach agreement on.
Dr. Stephanie Davies, thank you so much for joining us on the Conversation Hour.
Thank you so much for having me, Kirsten.
Dr. Stephanie Davies there, Chair of the AMA Victoria Doctor in Training Subdivision.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is the Conversation Hour.
You're with Kirsten Diprose.
And I'm loving the poster text messages. PJ in Ballarat says, last year to raise funds, we had to sell a beloved signed Sharon O'Neill Danced in the Fire poster. I have all my ABBA posters rolled up in a cupboard. I love them. What are they doing in the cupboard? Got to stick them up on the, I don't know, maybe not in the bedroom as you get older. It doesn't seem like a place. But a workshop? I don't know. Where do you keep your beloved poster? Is it up somewhere? Is it in the cupboard? We'd love to hear from you. 1300 222 774. Text in on 0437 774 774. Well, the person who has more posters than any of us, I'm sure, is Marcus Seal, who's the general manager of Rock Posters. Rock Posters is celebrating their 40th anniversary and actually opening up their Thornbury premises for Open House Melbourne in a few weeks at the end of July. Marcus, thank you for joining us here on ABC Conversation Hour.
Thanks for having me, Kirsten. It's a great pleasure.
Tell me what this building is like, because I've heard it's, you know, just a sort of nondescript building, two-storey Thornbury building. But what happens when you walk in? What do you see?
Well, it's a wall of sort of 40 years of Melbourne's cultural history, pretty much. Like every cultural organisation or performer, whether they be starting out or the biggest band in the world, has pretty much been through Rock Posters. And we've got half an acre of posters that are displayed throughout. They're largely been curated by factory hands over the years. So there's a lot of AC/DC, there's a lot of Kiss, there's a lot of Cold Chisel, but there's some really weird and interesting ones. And I heard Murray talking about Nick Cave. So there's some interesting old rare Nick Cave stuff, some Kylie Minogue stuff, some Beastie Boys stuff. Yeah, really, really fascinating. We've got a few groups coming in for 45 minutes, and it's going to be hard to get them to leave for the next group, I think, because people tend to stay a while when they come here. So, yeah.
Kylie Minogue, she was definitely up on my wall as a young person and teenager. I still love her to this day. But and I've been egged on to reveal what some of my posters were since I've been asking everyone else. So Kylie Minogue was one of them, Ricky Martin, and I also had, I think, Backstreet Boys at some point as well. So there you go. I am fessing up. Look, I would still have Kylie Minogue any time. I still think she is very worthy of any wall. 1300 222 774. Some more text messages. Hi, Kirsten. I've managed to save a few A4 and A5 band flyers from the Melbourne and Perth 80s, but my favourite is a large colour poster for the Laughing Clowns reunion tour 2008 to 2010. I can't recall if I bought it as merch or whether I liberated it from a wall at the Forum, says Steve in Altona. So, yes, these posters, are they that you have, the rock posters, are they originals that were screen printed? Have they been liberated from walls, or are they sort of mint condition versions?
Well, they're mint condition, but if they've been hanging from the roof of a factory for, you know, decades, they're, you know, they've probably seen a bit of wear. But we were the people that produced them, so and they were screen printed. They were, you know, not as glamorous as what they are now. But originally, it was probably two colours and maybe handwritten. We think that one of the first ones may have been the Hunters and Collectors Human Frailty Tour from 1986. Yeah, so they're all original. Nothing's, I mean, good luck trying to get them off a wall, because it's, we've seen a lot of people try over the years, and it's not a good way to get a poster. It's almost impossible to get them off walls without damaging them. But yeah, ours are all pristine, but they're a bit roughed up. They've got a lot of dust on them, but yeah, they take a good photo.
Yeah, and it's kind of adds to the story. What about the art of screen printing? Have we lost something in that now that we can, you know, mass print quite easily? And in the age of AI, oh my goodness, I have seen some horrendous posters of like, not music ones, but, you know, just people using AI, and it's terrible. Have we lost the art? A little bit.
Well, we haven't quite lost the art of screen printing. We still do it. It's a very manual process, and it's very rare. Like, I think the last people who asked may have been the Wiggles when they were reforming as the Cockroaches. They care about that sort of thing. But yeah, digital printing has largely taken over a lot of the printing world. There's also offset. We do three different methods of printing here, but yeah, look, we'd love to do more screen printing. It's a lot of people don't know what it is, and you know, don't. It takes us a lot longer, and it's probably more expensive now. So, yeah.
But amazing, so you still do it. So you can actually see how you do it. Like, you're a working, you know, screen printing facility.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, we've got a screen printer, an offset printer, and several digital printers, so we do all of it. So we're going to, during open house, we're going to show people or explain as much as we possibly can about the art of printing, not only about what we do print, but also how you print as well.
Marcus Seal is with us, General Manager of Rock Posters. Fiona says, hi, Kirsten, can you ask Marcus if these posters are worth selling? I suppose it depends how much you can put a price on love. But, yeah, are they worth a bit of money?
Well, from what we know, they are worth a lot of money, but we don't have a license to sell any of the posters that we've produced. So we've been getting calls from around the world for decades, wanting AC/DC. Kylie is pretty popular as well. But we don't sell posters. So, I mean, we'd love to have the license to be able to sell them. We did it with a Rob Hurst poster when Rob passed recently. We sold a commemorative poster that we designed to Midnight Oil fans around the world, but regularly we don't sell the tour poster because we don't have permission to do it.
this text. My posters were bought from my pocket money and I had a great time sourcing posters. I went to Central Station and bought the Iron Maiden Aces High poster.
Wow, wow.
For $12. I wonder what it is worth today. Mm.
Yeah, great memories. Yeah, I suppose you can find on eBay or somewhere. We've got massive, a lot of Iron Maiden vinyl posters from their tours, like massive ones, which are, you know, for Iron Maiden fans, they're like, get down there and worship in front of them. It's fantastic.
Let's go to the talkback now, and Graham is in Kensington. Hi, Graham.
Good morning. I think it's still morning, isn't it? Yeah, it is.
Yeah, it is. Tell us about your poster.
Well, to be quite honest, I can't remember where we got it from, but there were a collection of pictures of Frank Zappa sitting on a toilet completely naked that went around the university, and I managed to score one, I think. And then I took it home and we managed to convince my mum that it would look fantastic on the back of the toilet door at home.
That is brilliant. I don't think that's a poster I would personally love. But
he's a very handsome man and he looked particularly stunning sitting on this toilet. So
your mum is very kind. Is it still there?
We didn't really give her much of a choice. Well, unfortunately, that was about 60 years ago.
Right.
So it's unlikely that the new owners at a house have managed to keep it.
Oh, how long did it stay up for?
Oh, a couple of years, I think, until Frank fell out of my favourite collection. Yeah.
What other posters do you have?
Oh, look, these days my daughter is the big poster collector and she's sort of managed to frame them and put them all over her bedroom wall.
Oh, good on her. It's interesting, isn't it, that it's still so popular for so many people, even in this sort of digital world. Graham, thank you so much for calling in and sharing that story. Marcus, yeah, why do you think it still holds such a place, posters, today, even though we don't have to have them?
Well, we think that they've been around as long as the pharaohs. They were putting posters on walls thousands of years ago, and the nostalgic interest in tangible products in a very synthetic world has had a bit of a renaissance, I think. People like to see, we look at artists who have a billboard of themselves. They love getting a photo in front of the billboard, yet they put an ad for their tour or something on Instagram and nobody really cares. But if you've got a billboard, then it's real, it's tangible, it's something you can show your mum sort of thing. It's it's fascinating why people have gravitated towards it so much. And I think Melbourne is really interesting in that it's such a part of our culture, and I thought it would be more prolific in other parts of the world. And, you know, you think of New York and places like that, but there's not anywhere near as many posters in Manhattan as what there are in Melbourne.
What a great mantle to hold. This message from Kim in North Melbourne says, as the owner of a signage company, we have walls covered like Rock Poster Studio, but ours are signs. But we have an absolute obsession/respect for Rock Posters. The artwork and design of the early posters are stunning, plus the magnificent memories that they conjure. Isn't that lovely? What are some of the artists over the years that have really taken a great interest in the posters and the artwork that goes into them?
Well, I don't know. The Melbourne or Australian bands, Cold Chisel, a big one that celebrated red, black and white posters that they've done pretty much that they still do today. Midnight Oil have been a great supporter over the years, and we've got that famous yellow hand very proudly displayed.
Pink. Yes.
Pink has always used street posters and did a really a very clever woman by the name of Alex Kelsey, who works at TEG, sort of pioneered this new sort of poster. And some people might remember the Attack of the 50-Foot Woman that Pink was in. It was a fantastic poster. And I think AC/DC have been another one over the years that have ever since Gary Van Egmond was touring them a long time ago, and Michael Gudinski was probably one of the founding people who helped support this company as it started, with all the premier artists that they were promoting and all the mushroom group that they were promoting back in the 80s.
Fabulous. Much history. Marcus Seal, thank you for giving us a bit of theatre of the mind and walking us through the building. I can feel like I can almost see it.
Well, you can come and see it sometime if you like. So tickets are on sale tomorrow and thanks to Open House. So, yeah. So
yes, July 24 to 26, is that when it's open?
26 we're open, so it's only 3 sessions on the Sunday for us. So you probably want to get in quickly if you're interested. So
yeah, great. Thank you so much, Marcus.
Thank you, Kirsten.
Marcus Seal, General Manager of Rock Posters. So yes, as he mentioned, Open House Melbourne. Jump on the website and book your tickets if you'd like to see that. It's not often that the doors are open to see such a thing. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure being with you for this hour. I will be back tomorrow and for the rest of the week. This is The Conversation Hour. My name's Kirsten Diprose. Have a lovely afternoon.